There are lights. Oh, cool.
That's about it.
Yeah, I can use them. Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to be here in North Canton. We were in Canton itself in January, my family and I. So we got to see some of you then, but that's been almost a year ago. Time flies, and we have had a busy year doing a lot of things. I can chatter about that maybe a little bit more when we get to services this afternoon, but we do have some territory to cover in tracking the tribes of history. I picked the Tribe Tracker's Guide as a title for this back in 2006. I was trying to find a way to explain the identity of Israel to our young adults and therefore to our teens as well. They're bombarded by education that doesn't have a lick of sense when it comes to understanding the movements of peoples or really understanding history. History isn't really taught us history. It's taught us sociology. It's very soft history nowadays for the most part. If you want history, you study art history because the art historians don't care about sociology. They just want to know what happened when and what kind of art was made then. My daughter majored in art history and minored in art history and has done an analysis of the two. But I got to thinking when we were going to do a presentation of this at the feast in York in England in 2006, there's a Greek over there. His name is Stephen Constantine Moschides, a good friend. He's in the church there in the congregation in London. And I said, Steve, we wanted to get together and talk history. And he knew this subject was going to be a part of the Bible seminar. The ministers had asked me to cover this for the young adults that year. And when he found out about that, we had to spend one evening and one afternoon early in the feast, talking history. He loves to study history. And between my daughter and Steve and I, we had a high-speed, three-way conversation for 3 and 4 hours at a time. So I finally said, so when we get to the young adults Bible class at the end of the feast, it was going to be the night before the last great day, I said, do we want to go ahead and announce that it's a Tribe Tracker's Guide or it's going to be something to do with history? And he said, no, we don't want to do that because if you say the word history, their eyes roll back in their heads and they fall asleep. And I said, is that bad, huh? And he said, yeah. I said, it was pretty much like that in the States too. So he said, what we'll do is we'll get all the young adults together and we're going to have an activity in the afternoon. And he was coordinating these things with one of the other young adults. And then we'll have dinner at the same place that we've done before. And then we're two blocks away from a little hall that they had organized for the young adults Bible class. So we'll just walk over there and you can spring it on them. So he and I put together some maps and slides and things. Later on, after doing that, I wrote three articles for Vertical Thought. And you can just go to verticalthought.org and you can put in Tribe Trackers and my name and all three of them will pop up and you can print a copy and it will give you, by way of a handout, it will provide the core or the essentials of what we'll be covering here in the seminar today. But tracking the tribes of Israel through history and across the continents is quite fascinating. Let's start. First question I asked the young adults because I thought, oh boy, how am I going to get them interested in the study of the tribes and in history and how God has been doing through history? So it dawned on me at the beginning, I thought, I'm just going to ask them a question. I said, I have a question. I need somebody to volunteer to answer it. This was back at the feast there in England. And so they're all looking from one to the other and looking at me. And normally when you want to volunteer to answer a question, you give them the question. And then they volunteer. And I said, no, we're not going to do it that way. You volunteer, then I'll ask you the question. So one of them volunteered. And I said, okay, the question, Debbie, is, who are you? And they thought it was a trick question. And I said, I mean it, who are you? And so she gave me her name and her address. Okay, good. Now we know your physical identity. But who are you? And I want the rest of you to chime in. Where do you come from? Who are your people? And then they begin to realize, I haven't got any idea. And one of them gave the spiritual identity. Well, I'm a member of the body of Christ, a child of God, and looking forward to his coming kingdom. I said, that's your spiritual identity, but there's stuff that connects both your physical and your spiritual identity that goes far beyond your own lifetime, far back into history. And so before long, they were curious within just a few minutes, and then we launched. And those who, and there were several that I watch the audience while I'm speaking. I know mostly what I'm going to say next, so I can look at faces. And you had these looks up at the ceiling. Oh, we got to put up with this, you know, an hour of whatever's going to be said. Well, when we got into, after this introduction, and they're trying to think through why I'm asking these questions, pretty soon they were sitting on the edge of their seats, paying close attention and enjoying it, which I considered that to be a great triumph from a teacher's perspective when you get your students to be eagerly looking forward. Who are you was the question. Why identify and track the tribes of Israel? This question, the younger generation doesn't have any idea why. Mainly because we have not taught in the past few decades very extensively the identity of the tribes of Israel. We published on it, but we haven't taught it. So they don't know the reason why this is important. But it is. You could ask the question, well, why study history at all? Those questions have been answered. The further backward you look, the further forward you can see. For 2 cents, or no, 2 points. I don't have 2 cents with me. For 2 points, who is WSC? The initials. Churchill. Okay, good. What's the S stand for? Aha. Nobody knows. Winston Churchill actually had a hyphenated last name. Winston Spencer Churchill. And we mostly just know Winston Churchill. Had he not been the leader of the free world during the first half of World War II, you know, holding the line against tyranny from Central Europe, and had he not been such a dynamic politician in British, in Great Britain, he would have been the preeminent historian of the early 20th century, as far as being a prolific writer on history. The further backward you look, the further forward you can see. Take that to its extreme. When we try to understand what God is doing off into the eternal future in his kingdom, we look back as far as we can go. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. John 1:1 is the eternity into the past. Understanding how things move forward from there enables us to look forward into eternity, into the future. So history helps us understand and anticipate and appreciate what is coming. A good knowledge of history, this is one of my favorites, is like a quiver full of arrows in a debate. There's nothing I like better than a quiver full of arrows. I lose so many of them. A good knowledge of history is like a quiver full of arrows in a debate. And then finally, who said those ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it? Who? Nope, Jefferson didn't say that. It's a good guess. Leo Tolstoy said that. Don't you remember the doorstop that you had to read when you were in high school called War and Peace? Like 100 or 1,000 pages of it. Leo Tolstoy, but an American philosopher also said it, George Santayana. But I don't really care about what they said. I was concerned about what Betty Redfield said. When she said those ignorant of history at the end of her American history course are doomed to repeat it. And so we studied hard. We wanted to go to the 12th grade after we'd been in the 11th grade. So if we were ignorant of history after being taught by her for a year, then we were going to be back and she would teach us another year. So American history teachers often say that. The hard questions. This is about Israel. Was God unfair to choose a model nation? Now, the way to answer that is, hold it. Did God choose a model or a prototype nation? Israel was that. He did do that. Then was God unfair to choose that? And you get to the first part of the question is, was God unfair? No, God's not unfair. Now, that's something God did. The intent was that this nation would be a positive example for all the other nations. Were the tribes of Israel intrinsically superior to other nations? No. Just that God chose them, he gave them some blessings, gave them an opportunity. To whom much is given, much was expected. they didn't deliver most of the time. Was God disrespectful to other nations because he gave the tribes of Israel a special role in world events? No. Everybody has roles in world events. Various nations have had their eras of dominance in either a region or maybe even in the whole world. God organized all that over the course of time. Jesus Christ was prophesied. These are the reasons why we study history. Christ was prophesied to physically descend from one of the tribes of Israel. Of course, we know that was the tribe of Judah. Christ promised the 12 disciples that they will each rule the 12 tribes in the world tomorrow. And David will rule all 12. So David will be the king, and there'll be the kings under him. And then when you go back into the Bible, you'll note that God always identifies key nations at critical epochs or eras of history. For example, at the time of the Exodus, we knew who Egypt was, and we knew who Israel was, and we knew who Amalek was. Those were the key ones at the time of the Exodus. When they came into the Promised Land, then you had other nations, and they really weren't as big as what we would call a nation today. Often they were city-states or enlarged tribes. The 12 tribes of Israel were a nation, but they all had their subdivisions. And back in the time of Christ itself, we knew who Rome was. We know who Parthian Empire was. Now, you might not be fully aware of that, but you will when we're done. We knew who the Cretans were and who the Greeks were and who all the other nations around about that were a part of that dynamic era of history are all mentioned in the Bible. So why is it illogical then at the end of the age that God would identify nations from the Scripture? They're able to be identified ahead of time. The tribes of Israel were being a blessing to other nations. And when they did what was right, they were a blessing. Sometimes they were obedient. They were often rebellious. But they were examples. Nobody's worthless. At least you can serve as a bad example. And once in a while, they served as a good example to all other nations. Even more reasons. The ascendancy of the tribes of Israel, particularly of the tribe of Joseph, herald the second coming of Christ. That has to do with the prophecy of Jacob in Genesis 49, where he says, in the latter days, this will happen and that will happen and that will happen. And he went through each of the tribes, each of his sons, pronouncing a prophecy on what would happen to them, Joseph being getting the birthright and the dominance of them all. So the ascendancy of the tribes, especially of the tribe of Joseph, marks the coming of Christ, the second coming. However, it isn't just the ascendancy, it is also their descendancy right at the end when they have their downfall, just like Jerusalem had its downfall and the 10 tribes of Israel in the north had a downfall in their periods of history in the past. Then, and John alluded to this in the opening prayer, God's faithfulness to fulfill his promises to Abraham's descendants proves his faithfulness to fulfill his promises to you and me. So as we see God's hand in history, we should also be able to see God's hand in our lives. There's a direct correlation. Now, we need to understand that the Bible is the superstructure of history. It's not paleontology. It's not any of the disciplines of science who all reject the Bible. It is the Bible itself. We know that God made all of mankind. He made man, made the male and female after he had created the earth, you know, for this era of history. And he is made of one blood. This is the Apostle Paul talking to the Athenians in the sermon about the unknown God in Acts 17. He is made of one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth. And he determined their pre-appointed times. Different ones would have a period of greatness. And then somebody else would have a period of greatness. And the boundaries of their dwellings. Now, how did God determine the boundaries of their dwellings? In what ways could he do that practically that you can think of? Where God would design the boundaries of nations.
Put them in places where there were natural boundaries like mountains or oceans.
Mountains, oceans, rivers, and yes, exactly. Those are boundaries. Sometimes deserts also provided boundaries. So God thought through the geography as well as the history and had an overall plan for mankind. Now we come to the flood at Noah's time. These are the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations. And from these, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, his sons, from these, the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. So everything consolidated back to one family at the flood, and then it opened back up afterwards. In Deuteronomy 32, very interesting chapter for understanding the overview of God's work in history with mankind. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, He separated the sons of Adam, He set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. God anticipated delivering an inheritance, so He buried treasures like gas and oil and precious metals and gemstones. He buried them where He wanted them to be buried, and He would give certain nations those areas. He put topsoil where it would be abundant and rich, and all of the strategic geographical features of a nation were all placed ahead of time, and anticipating even the eventual populations. God works in history. Thus, if we're going to understand history, we can see that how He tracked, we can track the tribes, and it proves His working in history. Finally, we get to the beginning of God's relationship with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, and from that point forward, the Bible is largely a history of one family. And that's the family of Abraham, and then everybody else as they connect to it. I will make you a great nation, He said to Abram. This is before He changed His name a couple of chapters later. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. So we need to understand that the spiritual blessing, because the greatest blessing of all would be one of the descendants of Abraham, humanly, would be Jesus Christ when He came as a human being. From the third heaven as the at the right hand of the Father, and then He went back to the right hand of the Father later, but He came to be a physical descendant of Abraham. That's the greatest blessing that Abraham's descendants would be because of that particular descendant. And so there would be both the spiritual and then the physical blessings that God would give to Abraham's descendants. And when God gives a blessing, it is by His grace. When we talk about grace, most of the time, we only think of it meaning forgiveness of sin. Oh, it's far more than that. That's the main thing. And then it has a whole umbrella of other things. Any blessings, any mercy God shows us, any generosity, any favor, because technically grace in Greek, charis, means favor, divine favor in the case of God's grace. All come from God. So it isn't a question of race or racial greatness. It is an issue of God's graciousness to Abraham and then to his descendants, most of whom were recalcitrant, stiff-necked, rebellious, very irritating people. And for a lot of us, we're descended from them. So that's a little humbling in itself. Multinational greatness, because Abram would have his name changed to Abraham. Abraham means the father of many, as in many nations. And the descendants, again, would be a blessing to others. Now, the tracks of the Israelites in history. The Israelite history, an Israelite history. First, we want to look at Isaac. Itzhak, it's not pronounced Isaac by anybody but Americans and British. Everybody else says it. Itzhak, technically. The I is always an E. And we always see a big I, and it's an I in English. In German, it's Ich. So they use that E, sort of like a little mouse squeak. Isaac, as you remember, means laughter. You know, Sarah laughed when she heard that she was going to have a son in a year's time. And, of course, Jesus Christ, before His human birth, was right there dining with Abraham. She was at the edge of the tent. And He said, "Why did Sarah laugh?" And she says, "I didn't laugh." He said, "Oh, you laughed." No, she didn't laugh out loud. Don't have to with God. He can hear you laughing in your mind. And He said, "You laughed, and your son will be named Laughter." Some say, well, she had no faith, you know, that God would do that. I think that is a harsh treatment of Sarah. She laughed because it was a joy. Because she liked to laugh. I mean, when Abraham had been told that was in, chapter 19 of Genesis. And one or two chapters earlier, Abraham was told that he would have a son. And it wouldn't be Ishmael, through whom the covenant would go, and it wouldn't be Eliezer of Damascus, who was a servant born in his family. And he would actually have a son. He and Sarah would have a son, and he thought it was so funny, because here he's 90, almost 99 years old then, that he fell on his face and laughed before God. Now, Christ, you know, Jesus, before his human birth, Christ anticipated that, I'm sure, that Abraham, it was expected. In fact, some say that he told Abraham, you know, the last time I told that joke in Egypt, I had him rolling in the Nile. But anyway, so much for that one. Didn't go over so well. Think about it. History, geography, and wordplay. Jacob was renamed Israel, prince with God, or one who prevails with God. Israel, therefore, or Jacob, had 12 sons. They became the 12 tribes. Now, the bottom point, patriarchal characteristics. Patriarchal meaning the patriarchs of the 12 tribes. Just like Isaac, who was a patriarch of all of that, Isaac's characteristic of laughter translates into a sense of fair play. Who would you rather deal with? Somebody in authority. Who would you rather deal with? One who can laugh at himself or one who takes himself too seriously? You want to deal with the one who laughs, who has a good sense of humor, because that person will far more likely be fair. Those who take themselves too seriously and hardly ever laugh are dictators or dictators in the making. They do not have, you know, natural loving kindness that's lacking in their lives. Sense of fair play comes with a sense of laughter. So Isaac, then, his characteristic helps define the tribes altogether. But each of the individual patriarchs, their characteristics in Genesis, where you read about them growing up, tells you a little bit about what the nation that descended from that tribe would be like. There's a cultural proclivity that develops. Furthermore, other scriptures for your reference, and hopefully as you're going through the series, you'll spend some time just reading these and soaking them up. But Genesis 49, all the prophecies about each one of the tribes, I mentioned that one earlier. Moses was inspired to give a companion in Deuteronomy 33. He doesn't cover all the 12 tribes, I think it's 7 there, but he covers the major ones. Now, this is of interest as well as far as tracking the tribes, the genealogies. So-and-so begets so-and-so, and he lived this many years, and then he begets so-and-so, and then that person lives so many years, and he begets so-and-so, and you think, oh, why do I have to read this? You know, it's so boring. Until you start tracking the tribes through history. Then you realize, oh, well, this is very interesting. Genesis 46 is the genealogy that lists all the tribal patriarchs and their families, how many in their family, when they entered Egypt. Joseph was already there. And then you know all the story of how he then, all the rest of them came down during the famine and got settled in the land of Goshen, which was the Nile Delta at the north edge of Egypt. Then in Numbers chapter 1 and Numbers 26, at each end of the book of Numbers, it lists the tribes by their, the tribes and their clans. The clans, as we'll see later, were the names of the sons of the tribal patriarchs. Those became the clans. And it lists them at the beginning, right at the Exodus itself, and then 40 years later, what their populations were for each of those tribes. Then you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 2 through chapter 8. Now, this is in David's day, and it again lists the tribes and their clans and where they lived and their populations at that time. Now, a very interesting point that I've mentioned here, and I'll mention several times, so hopefully we'll remember it. Between Numbers, and that was around 1400 and 1440 B.C., and the time of David, which is about 400 and some years later, just a little over 400 years later, the spellings of the names of the clans, the clan leaders, or the sons of the patriarchs, the names change, the spellings change in most instances, slightly. It's still fundamentally the same and very recognizable, but even in Hebrew, over 400 years, it changed. I'll show you examples later. We'll see those. Now, 1400, Joshua, and then after Joshua came the judges, tribal behavior, future national characteristics. One of the key ones for finding tracks, and we'll use it as an example, is Deborah's song in Judges chapter 5. And if you want to turn to Judges chapter 5, I read a verse or two there, if I can get the light right. Now, if you remember the story of Deborah, she was the judge because there was no men in Israel that would take the responsibility. She had a commander who over the armies of the northern Israelites. Now, this is before they were separated from Judah, but they tended to be grouped together in a certain way. And she was in charge of apparently at least that area. His name was Barak, same as our current president in the United States. But no relation, I don't think. Barak was an Issacharite. So Deborah, finally, she says, let me just see if I can read this here, in verse 15 and 16, I want to read it, just the way she describes the tribes and their reaction. She called out the northern tribes to fight the Canaanite king and his commander, whose name was Sisera. And it was a big knockdown, drag-out battle where God intervened for them and ultimately destroyed the power of that northern Canaanite king, which allowed the ten tribes to have decades of peace. And we notice in verse 14, from Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek. After you, Benjamin, with your peoples, and from Machir, rulers came down. I notice I've underlined Machir. And from Zebulun, those who bear the recruiter's staff. The Zebulunites came by droves. The recruiters marched through Zebulun. We need you to come. We've got a battle fight to fight. And so they came. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah because Barak was their tribal leader. As Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley under his command among the divisions of Reuben. Among the divisions of Reuben. This is another phrase. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. They didn't come. Oh, but they felt so deeply about it. You know, we're with you in spirit. Hope you understand that. But we're not coming to the battle. We give the French a hard time in our modern times, too. And then we go on just a little bit more. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. They just stayed home with their sheep and wouldn't come and help fight this enemy. Gilead stayed beyond Jordan. Now Gilead is underlined as well. I'll tell you why. And why, notice this, why did Dan, the tribe of Dan, why did Dan remain in ships? What do you mean remain in ships? Israelites weren't into shipping, were they? Uh-huh. Tribe of Dan was. The tribe of Dan's inheritance, we've got a map in a little bit here, was right where Tel Aviv is today and slightly north where the city of Joppa is. That was all Dan. They were on the coast, one of the areas that could serve as a port. So Dan remained in his ships. And notice the condemnation of Asher. And Asher continued at the seashore and stayed in his inlets. When Deborah and Barak needed them, they didn't come either. And she wasn't very happy about it, and that's how she said it. Now, if you'll note, we have Machir and Gilead, and you don't see Manasseh named there. And you think, well, where's Manasseh? It's Machir and Gilead. Machir was the name of the son of Manasseh, and he only had one son. That would be the main body of Manasseh. Gilead was the half-tribe of Manasseh. And you think, well, who was Gilead? Gilead was the only son of Machir. Now, Gilead himself ended up with having 10 sons. So then you had lots of clans from Manasseh. But Machir and Gilead formed the two halves of Manasseh. Remember, when they came in with Moses, half-tribe of Manasseh wanted to stay on the east side of the Jordan, up in the north, in the area what later was then called Gilead or Bashan. And then the other half of Manasseh was on the other side of the Jordan where the main body of the Israelites were. So the half-tribe was always Gilead. And then Machir stood for the main body of Manasseh. Again, you track the tribes, you get an inkling of how they conducted themselves as we went along. Then we had King Rehoboam's tax fiasco. You remember this. When Solomon died, his son that became king was Rehoboam. Rehoboam had a face-off with King Jeroboam. Jeroboam was the leader of the northern 10 tribes. God gave them to him. Rehoboam ended up with the southern 2 tribes, meaning primarily Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin because Jerusalem was in Benjamite territory. And then there were some Levites, of course, that were mixed in. So we ended up with the house of Judah, with a capital in Jerusalem. The house of Judah would be the Jews. The house of Israel, because the one nation became two nations, and the house of Israel had its capital in Samaria, which was north and slightly west of Jerusalem, and they would have been the Israelites from then on. So we have, after this happened, you have the Jews versus the Israelites. Now, this is where most people lose track of the tribes, because they think that the tribes are all the Jews. And they aren't at all. There weren't even any Jews, generally speaking, until Solomon died and these two kings divided the kingdom in two. So this is an important point, to be able to discern between Jews and Israelites in history. First contact with Israel, this is a critical point in history, came under King Omri, O-M-R-I. And you think, well, who was he? Well, I'll tell you who he was. He was the 7th king of the house of Israel. He was not a descendant directly of Jeroboam, because the dynasties kept changing, but he was the 7th king. You know his son far better than you know Omri. His son was Ahab. You know his daughter-in-law, Jezebel, more than you know Omri. However, it was about this time, 882 to 870 BC, that was the time of his reign, that the Assyrians made contact with the house of Israel, probably began to trade with them, and so they always referred to Israel as the house of Omri. They didn't call it Israel in their cuneiform writings. It was almost always the house of Omri. We'll see how they said Omri later. Now, we have here Micah 6:16 makes a reference to the statutes of Omri are kept. Omri was a dedicated pagan and an apostate in that sense, but he was talented as far as developing systematic government. So he had statutes. And all the works of Ahab's house. Ahab had a certain talent, it's just that he didn't listen to God, as we well know. But Micah makes a reference, therefore, to those elements of the things that they had. They made a significant impact, not only on Israel, but on the nations around, including Assyrian Empire, which was far to their east. Now we jump forward from 870, 745 BC. 140 years later, thereabouts. 145. Pul. In the Bible, he's called Pul. In history, he is Tilgath-Pileser III. You think, why do they call him Pul? Pil. Pil became known as Pul, no doubt. It was a nickname or whatever that he was known by. He made the house of Israel into a vassal kingdom. That's 2 Kings 15:19. Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver. So he came down and either intimidated or conquered, defeated the Israelite army, but whatever the case, they became then a vassal kingdom and they just paid enormous taxes in order to not be destroyed. That didn't last long. That was 745. 11 years later, they rebelled. They get tired of it. Israelites always hated taxes, even still. So we have the second invasion of the Assyrians in 734 to 32. That's the first, which constitutes the first wave of captivity. The Assyrians were not a patient people. If you don't do what we say, we will beat you to a pulp. So that's what they did. And they came down and they took the land of Gilead. That would be the half-tribe of Manasseh's territory. And Galilee. And the half Manasseh, Gad, Reuben, Simeon, Naphtali, and Zebulun. And here, here tells that down here. And carried them away captive to Assyria. That's 2 Kings 15 and verse 29. This is an important point. Then they get lost in history in a minute. Now, here we go. This is the first wave of captivity took out Gilead. That whole area there is Gilead, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and Gad, and Reuben, and by this time Simeon had broken out of Judah, because Simeon didn't get an inheritance. They were scattered, mostly initially in the tribe of Judah's territory. But when the Edomites moved out, they came into here. And so it appears that the Assyrians made a sweep, which would have included, because we find the Simeonites wandering with the 10 tribes. That's why we say that. But these three are mentioned specifically. And Asher, and Naphtali, and Zebulun, and Issachar. That's called the area of Galilee. All taken into captivity. And then, about another 10 years later, see, it was 734 is when this fracas began. And why the Israelites kept thinking they could beat the empire of Assyria, I don't know, but they thought so. So 724 to 721, we have the third invasion of the Assyrians and the last wave of captivity under Shalmaneser. That was the emperor of the Assyrians. He took Samaria. That was their capital city in the center of Ephraim and Manasseh territory. And he took all the rest of the Israelites. They just, on a wholesale basis, they deported them. Modern historians can't comprehend that. For some reason, they can't comprehend mass deportations. But that's what happened in those days. The Romans actually did it too. I don't know why they can't imagine it, but they certainly don't imagine it because they don't respect Bible history. He took all of Samaria. Samaria was another term for the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, the 10 tribes. Placed them in Helah, in Habor, on the river Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. That's 2 Kings 17, 6 to 18. Now, here's a map that gives you an inkling of where they went. Here they were down here. Here's the Euphrates River there. There's the Tigris River there. And the areas that we mentioned are up in here and over in here. So up into here and up, and it seems that they migrated to the northern borders as well. In fact, I'm not sure when the map was put together. I don't know that this section up here was actually in the empire yet. So they were up at the northern reaches of it. But the arrows show where they were taken. Out on the border area there and what was probably a border area right in through there. Only Judah was left by 720 B.C. So the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, and God was angry with Israel, very angry, removed them from his sight, and left none but the tribe of Judah. Judah was the dominant tribe. Of course, Benjamin was there too, because it was 10 tribes and 2 tribes. And remember, their 13th tribe was Levi, so the priesthood had largely gone down to live in Judah when the split between the two nations came. A lot of the Levites were still up amongst the 10 tribes, and a lot of them ended up in the wandering with the rest. Assyria didn't last very long. By the early 600s B.C., they had reached their apex. And then we had the rise of the Sumerian and Scythian influence in the Assyrian Empire. Those are two groupings of Israelites. We'll explain how they come by those names in a minute. By 614, the Medes and the Babylonians assisting conquered Nineveh. That broke the main power of Assyria, but they had other cities they could fall back to. And it was a few years later that Nebuchadnezzar was involved in the Battle of Carchemish, where he defeated Egypt, Pharaoh Necho, and Carchemish, who was also the name of the Assyrian emperor at the time, at the Battle of Carchemish in 605. And the Assyrian Empire, according to historians, disappeared. I have no idea where they went. When we conquered Iraq in 2003, we found out there were a couple 100,000 Assyrians. They considered themselves racially to be Assyrians. They lived there in a certain part of Iraq. We didn't really apparently know that they were there. And there was just a tiny remnant. Everybody else disappeared. You got to understand, the Assyrians disappeared just like the 10 tribes disappeared. And modern historians don't know how to look for people who disappear, because they can't track things very well, I'm afraid, especially when they throw away the superstructure of history, which is sitting in your lap. Now, for reference, fall of Jerusalem came 586 B.C. Jerusalem fell to the Babylonian army of Nebuchadnezzar. And the Jews were already in the beginning of the 7 years of captivity near Babylon. The lost 10 tribes, however, the Jews got to come back. A significant portion of them came back and resettled Judea and Samaria, which were the traditional land of even modern history, nation of history of Israel. But the lost 10 tribes never came back. Never came back to settle and become a element there. Key prophecies, which you will have covered many times in the course, I'm sure, of these four seminars. The scepter will not depart from Judah, that there would always be a ruler, literally from the line of David, over the Israelites. That's Genesis 49. Judah was the Jews. The word Jews comes from the first syllable of Judah, the Jews. Some of Levi, Benjamin, and others, scattered ones. The United States and Britain come from Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh will be a great people, and he shall be great. These are superlative prophecies. They're not just regular statements. They're not just blessings. Well, I hope you grow up and do well. You know, these were prophecies that when Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. But Ephraim will be greater. He's the younger brother, but he'll be greater, and his descendants will become a multitude of nations. The greatest multitude of nations was the British Empire. No empire really has rivaled the influence of the British Empire in its day. Rome didn't. Parthia didn't. China didn't. Russia didn't. England was the biggest grouping, the most influential in its time. Manasseh is the single greatest nation in the world's history, the United States. Now, there are a few people who try to make a name for themselves and they want to switch. And they want to say that Manasseh, because it is 50 states, is a group of people, you know, the grouping of nations. Wrong. Our states are provinces. They are not individual nations. We have a union. We fought a really big war to define the parameters of that union. We have states and they are one nation. Britain was a collection of nations, a multitude of nations. In its empire days and in its commonwealth days. Tribe tracking national names. Now we come to some really interesting stuff. Let me see what... Oh my. We're going to talk fast. The word Eber is where we get the word Hebrew. And you think, well, where's Hebrew? Well, it's the E-B-R-E. In the middle of Hebrew comes from Eber. Eber was the great-grandfather of Abraham. King Omri... I told you he would come back, and Isaac. Now, how names morph. We had a neighbor who was a Dutch immigrant in South Dakota. His name was Case Moss. Cornelius was his real name. Case was a nickname. That's how he spelled it, Case Moss. And that's how he signed his name. Case had sheep. And he was a Sabbath keeper, and so we traded work back and forth. My father and he were good friends. And that worked with our schedule. One time he sold a truckload of ewes to a sheep rancher in Montana. And so the trucker was supposed to bring a check back when he took the sheep up there. So he drove up there and he got there and he told him, well, his name is Case Moss. And the rancher wanted to write out the check for the sheep. Case Moss. And the rancher's Case. He had no idea what Case was. So he thought, well, I know what Chase is. Chase is an abbreviation, an English abbreviation for Charles. But nobody goes by Charles around here, so it must be Charlie. And then the Moss, and who knows how the trucker, what his own way of saying Moss was. But when the rancher heard it, he thought it was Moose. And so he wrote the check to Charlie Moose. And sent it back, and Case took it to the bank, and the banker says, that looks right. I can see how your name could be Charlie Moose. So that's how it worked. Just in that little distance between three people, the name changed so dramatically. In America, we have, around here, in fact, we have Osage orange trees. The French noticed when they first explored through here that the tribes, the Indian tribes, all used that as their primary wood to make bows. So they called it, the French did, Bois d'Arc. Arc is bow in French, and wood, bois is wood. The D apostrophe is the of, wood of bows. The Texans and the Arkansans came along, and they heard this tree called the Bois d'Arc, but they don't speak French in Texas or Arkansas, so it became known as Bodark. and you say Bodark down there, they know exactly what you're talking about. It's the hedge apple or the Osage orange tree up here. The poor tree has so many names it gets dizzy with an identity crisis. Now, direction of the wandering is very important. These Israelites shall come from afar. This is a prophecy in Isaiah 49:12. It's about the second Exodus, when the Israelites are taken captive, and, you know, at the end of this age, you know, the tribes and the nations that are from the tribes. And in order for us to lead them back to the promised land, we will lead them from where they are. From, they'll be taken captive some places where they are and some places where they're hauled to. But whatever the case, it's north and west of the promised land. All directions in the Bible are relative to Jerusalem, unless otherwise noted. And then from the land of Sinim. Sinim means the south. There some would be from the south. Mostly north and west, and some from the south. Okay, let's look at the word Eber. It is a transliteration of Ibri or Ivri. Ooh, hold it. Notice this. Ibri or Ivri. Did I say Bri or Vri? The B's and V's are phonetically identical because they're hard to tell, especially on the phone. But that's a descendant of Eber. The word, the name Eber, is derived from the Hebrew word Aver. It means across or stranger, like over there. Not here, but over. Hebrew Aver and the English over are the same word. Bear in mind, ancient Hebrew did not have any vowel sounds written down. Vowels were all handed on from word of mouth, generation to generation. They only had consonants. So you had VR or BR, as the case might be. This also shows the roots of Hebrew. The roots of English are in Hebrew. So we have some names on maps. I'll show you a map in a moment. Iburnia, Tiber, it's a river beside Rome. Whoa, that's weird. Iberia, and that's the Iberian Peninsula in Spain. And the north of that, there's a river called the Iber River, but on most maps in Europe, it's called the Ebro. Oh, so Iber is Ebro. Ah, yes, the vowels move, the consonant sounds remain close to the same. Siberia, there's Iber again. And what were they doing in Siberia? Well, that's a fascinating story, I'll tell you. Hibernia was an ancient name for Ireland. That's Hebrewia, essentially. In Scotland, you have the Hebrides, the inner and the outer island chains up in Scotland. You have York in northern England, which was called by the Romans Eboricum, and Eboric by the Vikings. Ebor, very likely derived from Hebrew. Those who lived in the north of England were called Hyperboreans in ancient times. The Hyperboreans, nobody knows who they were. They aren't sure when they were. It's hard to take radiocarbon dating off of rocks because rocks have been around forever, you know. And then Humber. In England, the Humber River comes right through here, just below York. York is the capital in the Middle Ages, or the late Middle Ages, when Queen Elizabeth was there. There was a huge section of the country called Northumbria. Northumbria. Still there. They still call that region Northumbria. Okay. So we have Hebron. That's named after Eber. Up here, this little area here in ancient times was called Ibernia or Iberia, just like over here, the Iberian Peninsula, the Ebro River. The Tiber River is there. See, we're moving west and then north to get the northwest direction from down here where Jerusalem is. Siberia was north and then west, quite a ways north. We have the inner and outer Hebrides, Hibernia, an ancient nation of name of Ireland, Aberdeen, Bergen in there, the Oder River down here. Those are just a few of the Eber names that you can find where the Israelites went. They left their names behind them as they went, names of things. Now, we go to the name Omri, King Omri. On the Black Obelisk in the British Museum, we got to tour that in 2007, there is a line that says, translates it, the tribute of Jehu, son of Kumri. Jehu was actually, or Jehu, as we usually say here, was the king who wiped out the dynasty of Ahab. So he was not technically a son of Omri, who was Ahab's father, but he was the king of that same country, so they referred to him as the son of Kumri. The Assyrians called Omri Kumri, or Gomri, because they couldn't say Omri, they had to come out with a guttural Gomri. Just like many Chinese cannot say their R's very well, especially in the middles of words. And they're very sorry about that. They just can't form them. South Africans can't do the I sound. It comes out as uh. You can't get milk in South Africa, you get mulk. And you ask them, we tried this, ask a South African, can't you say milk with the I, mulk? And we had, it was when I was at college. And he was a doctor. The South African was. And he could not say "eh." It came out "ul" because of the Afrikaans influence. So you can see why they would say Gomri or Kumri. It might be spelled either way. It couldn't say Omri. That became known as you travel through historical atlases. Gomri, Gimri, because the vowels will change periodically. The hard C will imitate the G. So Kimrians. And even today, that name lives on. The Welsh recognize that they are from the Kimbri. They're a part of the Kimrians. This was a super grouping of tribes. It wasn't just one tribe. It was a group of tribes. But that name you will find in history and on maps as one way to track the tribes. Then we look for Isaac. And Isaac shall your seed be called. And because Sarah said, I want you to have Hagar and her son go. And God said, listen to what she says, Abraham, because in Isaac will your seed be called, or in Yitzhak will your seed be called. The consonantal core of in Hebrew for Isaac is the SK or a hard C with the S as an SC. Now, you think, well, where in the world do we find that? Well, how about these? Scythian. You're not so familiar with those, but they were the groupings of the Israelites, a general term that was used for them, if they were west of the Caspian Sea, not long after they were taken captive. Later, you find Scute as they move further north in Scotia. Oh, yeah, just like Nova Scotia, New Scotia. Scotland has the SK or S hard C, SC. Scandia was the old name for Scandinavia. That's all the name of Isaac being tracked down through the as the tribes moved. And that's one of the things you'll look for on maps. If you look at the eastern branch of Isaac's name, they were called the Saka. And so the Sk, you ended up with the S and K being separated slightly. Saka, Saka, or Saka. Just spelled differently. East of the Caspian Sea, and for hundreds of years, it extended clear out to China. And there were, for longer than we've been a nation, we had Israelites out there raiding the Chinese. Which is why the wall was built, keep them and the Huns out. Iskuza, Sake, some other variations, Sakasini, as they begin to migrate back into Europe, the Sakasone, or which means the sons of Saka or the sons of Isaac. And then finally that got folded down to Saxons. Saxons means the sons of Isaac. Archaeology, Behistun rock inscription. This is found on the road even today between Baghdad and Tehran, the borderlands of Iraq and Iran. It was known to be there, but the archaeologist from England in the 1860s, I think, Sir Henry Rawlinson, climbed the cliff and made the rubbings of all the writings that are up and down here. This is an actual illustration or a photograph. I think this is an illustration of what he did. He made meticulous drawings. The tall pointy hat here, this man is wearing trousers. For those of you over here, that was a Scythian. They wore trousers and pointy hats. The hat's kind of exaggerated, but that was part of their territory, or part of their uniform. The Behistun rock was carved under Darius the Great, early 500s B.C., it listed the nations and tribes that he conquered. In the previous one, this is Darius here. And here he's got his foot on one of the people he conquered. And the rest of them are all captives. They're all, their necks are tied together with a rope or a chain. Whoops. Parallel translation, these lines of writing were in three columns each time. And it turns out that they were parallel translations, word for word, of Old Persian, Susian, and Assyrian, or Old Babylonian. Now, when Sir Henry Rawlinson did the rubbings to collect these, he could read Persian, he could read Susian. They had no idea how to read the cuneiform tablets that they were beginning to excavate out of Nineveh. He was the one who discovered the site for Nineveh. It was in the middle of the desert at the time. But that by taking these translations from the Behistun rock inscriptions, then they finally broke the code to where they could read the Assyrian or the Old Babylonian language. And you wonder, why is Assyria and the Old Babylonian? Assyria ruled Babylon for a long time. So this was the key to translating Babylonian and Assyrian. So the bottom line out of it, the Sakae or the Saka, meaning the Scythians or Scythians, as we sometimes soften the sea, are the same people as the Gemiri or the Cimmerians, those named after Omri. They're the same peoples based on that rock inscription. So archaeology is a huge way to track to the tribes. That's just one part of it. George Rawlinson up here was a brother to Sir Henry, and he was more the historian. Henry was the archaeologist. His assessment is, we have reasonable grounds for regarding the Gemiri or Cimmerians and the Sakae of the Behistun rock as identical with the Bet Cumri. Bet, B-E-T-H, we say Beth, the T-H comes out as a T in Hebrew. Bet means house of, the house of Omri. Cumri is another way, the way the Assyrians said Omri. Or the 10 tribes of the house of Israel. The Rawlinsons could see this when they were doing their preliminary and primary historical research in the 1800s. Now we have clan names. Here we have Reuben. Now Reuben has some translation, some names that you can see the word Reuben in it. Here's sons were Hanok, Palu, Eliab, Hezron. Most of these you will find in various places. The Huguenots, particularly, taken from Chanak, he become Hugo. The G and the CH exchange. And the Huguenots were from France. Simeon became known as the Samnites. There was a Samnite kingdom on the back of the heel. If you can imagine a snake biting the back of the calf of Italy, right on the back of the leg of Italy, the Samnites had a kingdom there that took, it lasted about 500 years before the Latiums, who became known as the Romans, finally conquered them. Here's an interesting point. Notice this particular name, Yamin or Jamin, who is the son of Simeon. This is what he's called in Numbers. Jemuel is what he is called in Chronicles. See how the name changed in 400 years? There was a grouping that stood out of the Vikings, a group of the Yam Vikings. In Hebrew, that would be Yam, Yamin. Yam would be the key consonant. So the Yam Vikings seem to be from Simeon. They have all the other indicators of Simeon too, because this Simeon was a fighter. Remember, he and Levi were born to fight. There's a Samnite warrior from that Samnite kingdom. Now we have Gad. Gad would only be said as Gad in America because we do flat A's. Nobody else does a flat A like we do. It's aw. Got. The D becomes a hard T. The TH in Hebrew also is pronounced as a hard T, not as a th like we do, goth, but it'd be got. So the got or the gate, gute, there's a grouping that we'll read, I'll show you on the maps later, Massagete, which is Manasseh and Gad together. Chinese called them Yuchi. They were the ones who fought with the Chinese. The Gutones up near Scandinavia, Gadini, and then again we go through some of the clans of Gad are here. I won't spend any time looking at those. Judah, Jews, and we look for this because of 1 Kings 18:13, King Hezekiah's time, the Assyrians came one more time, and they were going to take Judah too. But it didn't work because Hezekiah prayed, and God killed 185,000 in the army of the Assyrians who were besieging Jerusalem. One night they were alive, and the next morning they woke up dead. And so, that's what it says in the King James. And in the morning they awoke, and behold, they were all dead. All right. So then Sennacherib went back to Assyria, and that was the end of it. But before he came against Jerusalem, he took the border cities of Judah captive. 200,000 ultimately were taken. He went against all the fortified cities out on the border of Judah and took them. 46 cities, I think it was. So you know that there were some of the tribe of Judah who were in the wanderings then. And likewise, when the Angles and Saxons conquered England, they were assisted by the Jutes, which would seem to be, again, the tribe of Judah. Zebulun. In the Scythian times, Zebulistan was the name for Afghanistan. They ruled Afghanistan. Zebulun, see that last two syllables, Ulan, is very similar to his son, Elon. From Elon, we have the Alans, the Alani, the Roxalani, and that's where we get the word Aland, is from Alan, or Elon, or Ulan. You're looking for pieces of the name. And this etymology of philology of the study of names and how they morph through time is important. And John's got some really interesting things to show you. Dan will be a judge. Dan had one son. His name was Husham. Dan would also be a serpent in the path. And there's Dan everywhere. Adana. The Greeks, the southern Greeks, and the Trojans called them, said that they were descended from the Danai. And I'll explain that next in the sermon time. We have Dan sailing at the time of the Judges, the 1200s BC, which was when the Black Sea was colonized, and the rivers were named. So you have the Danube, you have the Dniester or the Dnieper. There we go. There's the Russian name for it. And then up here you have the Don River coming down. The Don River has a tributary right there called the Donay. Up in here is the Dana River. You have Danzig in Holland, or you know where it is, Poland. Dunkirk. These are all Dan. D-N, the D-Ns. Denmark, Dundee, Don River in Scotland, Donegal and Bay in Ireland. In Ireland at the time, this time, we have the Tuatha De Danann. And don't forget, London may well have been the name of Dan used as well. The capital of Scotland was Edinburgh, but it had an ancient name called Dunduin. Again, the Dan names used there. Danite traditions I'm going to save. Ephraim, where did Ephraim, how did Ephraim come down to us as England? In Jeremiah, Ephraim is bemoaning himself. You chastised me, and I was chastised like an untrained bull. The symbol for Ephraim, their banner when they marched in the wilderness under Moses, was a bull. Ephraim says, I am chastised. He's repenting here in Jeremiah 31. I'm like an untrained bull. The Hebrew word for bull is egal. Egal. Egaloi, they were the bull people. The Egaloi became the Angeloi. Or the Anglos and the Saxons. And England is named as Angleland, meaning the Angles land. So the philology and the etymology, I think you can see the trail, how that could easily be done. And you end up then with Ephraim being named the land of the bull, essentially, is what England is named after, the Hebrew word for bull, which was their symbol. Ephraim had these clans. The interesting clan was his grandson, Aaron. That was one of the ancient names of Ireland. England owned Ireland part of the time. Irin, Erin, Ari, Hiri. And notice also, there was a time when Ephraim was in the Middle East, and we have a nation named Iran, Heran, and Erin. And the R, those are all variations, or easily could be variations of Aaron, his grandson. Joseph has various names. Machir, this is the genealogy of Manasseh. That's his son. That's Machir's son is Gilead, and those are all the names of Manasseh's sons. You can read those in the genealogy chapters. Now I'm going to get in, we're getting to the close of this. How does Manasseh get to be America? Well, it isn't Manasseh, it's Machir. Bear in mind, Manasseh only had one son. So Machir is going to carry as much influence as a name, historically, as his father's name, Manasseh. If you say HaMachiri in Hebrew, you mean the people of Makir. That's what how you say it. Hamakiri. And they, well, that sounds like America, said by somebody that likes to put eyes on the ends of their words. There were, in history, the Amirigan, Hamirigan, the people of Makir, Skiths, the Isaac name. Then there were the Amirigo Skute, as they moved into a different language. In the old Babylonian, it was the Gimiri Umurga. The Gimiri, well, that's Omri's name there, but the Umurga is Amira is Makir, their way of doing Makir. In Saxon Germany, you had a Saxony of Germany, you had Umurgi. And then later, the Murings and the Mercy, Mirisch, and the Meringas. And there were seven ancient kingdoms, well, not super ancient, but reasonably ancient kingdoms of England before they were united as a kingdom, became England. And one of the major ones was Mercia, or Mercia. Again, the key consonantal sounds out of Makir, the M and the C or K and an R. Now, we all heard in school that America is named after who? Amerigo Vespucci. Was Amerigo Vespucci a king? No. What was his trade? He was a map maker, a cartographer. He was an Italian map maker. Now, why would you name a continent after a commoner and use his first name? We should be living in the United States of Vespucci land. Technically, because he was a commoner. Now, here's the connection. Amerigo was Jewish. The Jews had a market on education in the late Middle Ages because they were the only ones who had books. The Catholic Church kept burning the books. The Jews saved the books. So they had knowledge. And thus he ended up being a map maker in Italy. But he was named after a famous Jewish prince in Spain. There had been a Jewish kingdom in Spain 400 years earlier. And just at the time of, around the time of Charles Martel and his son Charlemagne. And that Jewish prince had been brought from the Middle East by Charles Martel, the father of Charlemagne, at his wife's suggestion, and she was Jewish, go and get some of the princes of Judah and bring them here to rule this strategic kingdom on the border of France and Spain. They were trying to hold the Moors back. This is in the 700s AD. The Moors being the Muslims that were trying to conquer Europe from Spain. So they did. And one of those, there were several brothers. And one brother became the great hero of the Jewish people, you know, historically, because he led them and they were able to hold back the Moors from crossing the Pyrenees at Narbonne, was the name of the kingdom. His name was Makir. Prince Makir. Now you think, well, hold it. Why? He was Jewish. Why did he have a Manassite name? Well, it didn't matter. It was a Hebrew name. But his name was Makir. And Amerigo Vespucci, Amerigo is the Italian version of Makir. So if, in fact, we are named after Amerigo and not after Richard Amarik, who was a Bristol ship owner in Bristol, England, and who had his ships sailing down into New England and in Canada fishing for codfish well before Columbus sailed the oceans blue, which is another possibility. Amarik, America, you could see the last name of Richard Amarik being on the map. Interestingly, the two stories merged. Amerigo Vespucci was on a Spanish expedition with a very bloodthirsty admiral that they had. They went around the Caribbean, around the Gulf Coast, and started up the East Coast at the same time that John Cabot, who was Portuguese, sailing for the Bristol ship fishing industry, had a three-ship expedition going south down the eastern seaboard of the United States. And John Cabot's ships never came home. But the Spaniards came home with Amerigo and with better maps than they left with. So one historian's suggestion is that that admiral had a habit of destroying anybody that, you know, weren't friendly to him. And then you would always try to take the ship's map because the map was precious knowledge for the sailing industry at the time. Thus, Amerigo Vespucci may have ended up with an English map that had America already labeled on it. Who knows? But Amerigo is Makir. Richard Amerique is derived from Makir. Makir is Manasseh. So America is named after Manasseh's son, Makir. Now, I think this is John's turn to come up here and tell us this. This is fascinating.
We have a couple of slides here because one of the things that critics use is the argument of philological evidence, is it reliable or not? I mean, we had a long dissertation about names and they merge and they go and they morph. So, you know, you can see the commonality in that, but then the question comes, is it reliable? Does this actually happen? Is there a way that this could be proven? And what I put up on their slide here is there a control group that you'd be able to support whether or not this happens over time? Actually, there is. I've got the Amish control group. And you're probably wondering, how does this connect? The Amish are one of the fastest growing ethnic groups in the United States, make an excellent control group because they have maintained a separatist lifestyle going back nearly 500 years to their founding of the Swiss Brethren in 1525, which in 1525 was the first documented adult baptism upon confession of faith, and then the groups sprang up from there. So we're looking at a group of people that both from a language standpoint and a cultural standpoint stayed separate as they migrated throughout Europe and then later to the United States over a period of 500 years. They came from Switzerland, they moved into Germany, portions of France, came to the United States, first to Pennsylvania, and then later to Ohio. And again, one of the interesting trivia about the Amish right now is that from 1992 to 2010, they have doubled in population, which means that over 50% of their population is under the age of 18, which is an interesting phenomenon in itself. But the Amish have maintained a form of the German language known today as Pennsylvania German throughout this whole time, while speaking High German, English, and other languages and dialects to the outsiders as they migrated through Europe and America. I'll cite an example of this. When we were living in Germany, I did some genealogical research, and we found death records of one of Susan's great-great-grandparents, and when they died, he was known as the Swiss that lived among us. So even back in Europe, they maintained a separatist identity. So because they have maintained a meticulously documented separatist lifestyle for nearly half a millennium, it's a good linguistic and cultural control group. I have my genealogy back 12 generations with birth dates and death dates and who married whom, et cetera, et cetera, and that is very unusual. Okay, now, let's talk about the Yoders and the Rabers and the Troyers. I mean, this is, Yoder is, next to Miller, probably one of the most common names, because they took the commandment to be fruitful and multiply very seriously. But is that their real tribal name? You know, everybody thinks it's the Yoders down the street. But that's not what, when they speak among themselves, it's a completely different name. Same is true with the Rabers. So, okay, I have an uncle that was a Troyer, I have a grandmother that was a Raber, and my mother was a Yoder. So I'm related to all these folks. That's a nice thing. You're all cousins about 20 different ways. It's a good control group, remember? But I'm saying this because I want to demonstrate that what Mr. Stivers has taught us is not some far-out theory, okay? Look at this. The Yoder is the contemporary English name. Now, when my great-grandfather, 9-10 generations removed, came to the United States in the 1830s, his name was Michael Yoder, J-O-D-E-R. I have a copy of his Hessian passport. So if you want to talk about documentation, I got the goods, okay? He moved into Germany, and in order to gain entry, he had a German Hessian passport that is still, the original is still in the family. It was spelled J-O-D-E-R, Jota. It's the High German version. Nobody in our family ever said Jota or Yoder. We were all the Yetas. So if you look at the progression of the same name, and here you have a name that's very prominent that over hundreds of years is still maintained. When we speak our German dialect and we want to talk about the Yoders, we don't say Jota or Yoder, we say Jota to this day. My grandfather was Benj Jota, and we have Andy Jota. We have dozens of them down there. Okay. You see the same kind of progression, and let's go look at the Rabers. Raber is the contemporary English name. We never talked about the Rabers in our dialect. The High German version of it is Reba, R-E-B-E-R, because that's a derivative, and it ties to a person that works with the vine. Reben is the German word for a vine. But Amos Reba is a minister in our church. He was never Amos Reber, okay? They were the Reba. It's pronounced R-A-Y-V-A. It's a rough transliteration of it. Then we've got the so-called Troyers. I have an uncle who died a few years ago. And, no, he didn't die. My aunt died. He's a Troyer. That's how they spell their names. That's what people see. But that's not what we call them in our tribal dialect. They're the Dryos. So these are contemporary examples in a control group that goes back 500 years that had a similar migratory pattern of what we just discussed. So I thought that would be an interesting way to demonstrate that what we're talking about is not some voodoo history that never happened.
Okay, we'll wrap up this first section real briefly here, but a fascinating piece of, you know, background information that helps us understand how the languages move through, or how names move through languages. Some say, well, how can, you know, you can possibly tell where the Israelites are? You know, they've all so intermarried, you can't possibly identify them. Well, don't have to. God knows. God knows who's what. He keeps track of those things. And so he says, surely, this is Amos 9, verses 8 to 9, surely I will sift the house of Israel among all the nations. As grain is sifted in a sieve, yet not the smallest grain will fall to the ground. God can track the tribes. He can track the families and the identities of them until he knows which are the Israelites. Now, see into the first half. The next time we're going to, during the sermon time, blessings of best places and things, legends and traditions, art, history, linguistics, historical maps, national and tribal characteristics, and tribe tracking in the New Testament and into the future. Here are some of the maps that we'll look at. You've seen that one, but you haven't seen this one. In 650 B.C., that's what the area looked like. And in 300 B.C., it began to look like that. In 150 B.C., and then in 150 A.D., and then 300, you know, Roman Empire is pretty big then, A.D., but 500, everything just broke loose. And we'll talk just a little bit about that as we get into the sermon. So that's it for the Bible study. I think you're going to ask a blessing on the lunch or an announcement.